Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. The video that you're about to watch is an interview that I did with Scott of Loving Life on the 18th of February 2022. This is actually the sixth interview I've done with him, and I'll be putting up the other ones. Since Scott is an ex-South African, now living in Australia, and the show is mainly a show where white South Africans are listening in, we are focusing a lot on white history in Africa, and I have been going into my database and hauling out all my old African crisis stuff. So the very first thing I wanted to discuss was my visit to P.W. Botha, President P.W. Botha, and my discussions with him. So prior to this, I spent a couple of weeks actually setting up my old database and actually writing some software so that I could search through it and look at it and see what is in it, because I ran it from 2001 to 2012, just to the end of 2011 actually. That is the main database that I've got. There should be another database, but I haven't found it yet. That one relates to a quieter time from 2012 to about 2014, but I haven't found it yet. But the one that I have got is the most important one, and I wanted to specifically look through my P.W. Botha stuff. So I have published the video, which is the last interview of P.W. Botha, which took place in January 2006. But in this particular video, we are merely discussing some of the things I discussed with him, how it was that I got to know him, etc. But this is by no means everything. In fact, I'm sitting with 16 pages of notes from when I visited P.W. Botha that I need to go through and record and compile that into a video as well. And I've also got photos from then. I took among the last photos that were taken of him alive when I was at his house. So before we get into the interview, I just want to touch on a couple of points that come up in the interview that I think need a bit of clarifying. The first thing that Scott does is that he plays some video about a trial for P.W. Botha. This happened after the end of apartheid. So now we're under black rule, and the blacks now are doing this thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This very nice sounding name is a load of junk, and it pertains to what is in fact South Africa's Nuremberg trials. So what the blacks did was they had this thing called the TRC, which the whites agreed to be a part of. And in this TRC, which is Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it's actually a Nuremberg trial, just like what happened to the Nazis. So what it's all about is we had a war, and now we are going to come clean and take out our dirty laundry, and we're going to put it out into the open, and then everybody's going to kiss and make up. But the reality is that the real goal here, the way it was played, is really to try and get the whites to admit to all kinds of crimes and then to hammer the whites on it. Then when it's the blacks' turn and the blacks are supposed to tell their side of the story, of course everything the blacks did in order to defeat apartheid was good, and everything that we did to defend our power structure is bad and evil. So former presidents, former generals, former members of parliament were all hauled into this court. And the guy running it was a guy called Bishop Tutu. So if you take a look at that cartoon that's on the screen there, that is a cartoon from that time. And of course it's not a flattering cartoon because it's drawn by the enemy. But P.W. Botha had married his second wife. And so the short guy that you see next to him is Bishop Tutu with a subpoena to appear at the TRC. And so the joke is he's showing his wife's ring, but in actual fact he's showing this black bishop Tutu, he's actually showing him the finger. P.W. Botha refused to appear at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He regarded it as a clown show. He regarded it as garbage. He lost the court case regarding appearing at the TRC, but he then took the matter to the Supreme Court, where he won. So basically, he showed them the finger regarding the TRC, and he refused to appear. But he did compile 2,000 pages of documents, which he submitted to the TRC, and as far as I know, I don't think they ever did anything with it. So P.W. Botha was the only president to stand up a bit for himself and for the Boers and the whites. He was the only guy who showed any kind of balls at the end. And this, of course, is many years after he'd already been thrown out of power. But he still had more balls than any of the other whites who had been in parliament, or even the weakling de Klerk. The weakling de Klerk was the fool who just handed South Africa over. So you will see some film footage that Scott shows that pertains to this event, where P.W. Botha actually stands up and he even tells the mass media and he says what he wants to say. So the only white man with any kind of balls left at the end of this disgusting setup. And this is a setup, make no mistake. There are things that the blacks did, crimes that the blacks committed, and then those things were all hidden, etc. So the whites came out a lot better than the poor Germans at the Nuremberg trials, because at the Nuremberg trials, it was a one-sided thing, and it was simply a case of find the Germans guilty, have them executed, end of story. At least this thing wasn't that ugly. But even so, it was meant to be a place to beat up the whites, let the liberal Jewish mass media come talk their shit, and let the blacks also run around talking about how evil the whites were, etc., etc. And this Bishop Tutu, like all these black Christians, they're totally worthless. They are actually people who end up working against the whites. So you got these black Christians, and the black Christians just knife the whites in the back. It's a very disgusting setup. And all these black Christians, I must tell you, they are very much a big disappointment. But that's a topic for another day. So the other thing is, who was Nelson Mandela and who was he working for? In his show, Scott likes to talk about the New World Order, but Nelson Mandela had certain friends. Nelson Mandela was a communist, but he started out as a black who went and became a lawyer. And guess what? He worked for a Jewish attorney. Nelson Mandela's actual boss that he worked for was a Jew in Johannesburg. And is it surprising that after working for a Jew, the next thing is Nelson Mandela becomes a communist terrorist? And the next thing you know is Mandela is busy unleashing terrorists across South Africa, and he and other blacks and a bunch of Jews all get caught, and they are put on trial for treason, for wanting to unleash thousands of terrorists across South Africa. Nelson Mandela, in his trial, had a document in his own handwriting called How to Be a Good Communist. Nelson Mandela is a communist. A communist with Jewish affiliations. And then later, when he comes to power, then you find he's hobnobbing with all these elites, all these liberals, all these New World Order lots, etc. At the end of the day, you will find that communism, Jews, New World Order, all those things come together, and it's all anti-white. But Mandela was definitely part of the communist groups. These people were funded by the Russians, they were helped by the Chinese, and the documentation for it is piles and piles of documentation regarding that. This also ties back to the Total Onslaught, which P.W. Botha mentioned in his last interview. The Total Onslaught, all the countries that were working to destroy white South Africa. So anyway, I just wanted to give you that background. Watch the interview. We chat about all kinds of different things, but it's by no means comprehensive, though we touch on all kinds of different topics. And the other thing is, I need to do a whole ton of recording relating to all the notes that I have from my discussions with P.W. Botha. There are many things that I need to discuss there. But this will start giving you some idea of some of the things we discussed. But like I say, it's by no means the full thing.
Goeiedag, good day, fellow South Africans and citizens of the world.
Okay, so let's move on now, because I've got Jan Lamprecht waiting in the wings. But before I bring Jan on, just by way of introduction to our subject, which is P.W. Botha, let me play this short video. This is related to his court case following his refusal to go to the that special conference where there were, I've forgotten the right the words, but it's at trial and something. Here we go. Anyway, you'll see about it in here.
Car, guys.
Meneer Botha, kom gesels met ons.
Mr. Botha.
Mr. Botha.
I'm on the way.
Ek baie welkom hierso. This country is in confusion. Go and ask the citizens of this country, and they will tell you that they are not satisfied with what is going on all levels of government. And it is a lovely country. It is a country full of hope. And I hope that sense and justice will prevail. I'm the accused, and I have the right to be protected by the court. Is that right? But untested accusations have been made by a witness without being cross-examined. while he's untested witnesses, evidence was distributed right through the world. I saw it on television. Now I say it is my right as a citizen of South Africa that my law advisors shall continue to cross-examine the witness as well as his chairman of the commission, Bishop Tutu, who is the chairman of the commission, and that he shall also appear before court to be cross-examined. I had an opportunity in my office here to tell Mr. Mandela, but apparently he's a captive. He's a captive of the cabal, and he's a captive of interests from which he cannot escape.
Why are they going
He is a decoy dove. You know what a decoy dove is? That is what he is.
Why do you think that they are going after you? Why do you think they've picked on you, sir?
Because they want to destroy the image of my people. And they want to destroy my image, and through me, to humiliate my people.
Okay, guys, that was P.W. Botha, and wow, what a very astute man he was. He talked about the cabal. You know who the cabal are, don't you? The New World Order. That's who Mandela was a front for. And the court case was related to his refusal to appear before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Sorry, I had a bit of a brain blank there for a second. All right, now just before I get our guest Jan Lamprecht on, I just want to read a message that was put in the side chat at the very start of the side chat, and it was from Estelle Deventer, or Deventer, and Estelle writes, "Hi, Loving Life, this should be interesting. My brother was one of the directors who advised Mr. Botha. My brother also authored a book on Mr. Botha, who is known as Die Groot Krokodil. Now, Estelle, I'd love to know who your brother was. I'm going to be just raising that with Jan Lamprecht, who I'm going to get on now. Here we go. There we are. Now I see you. Okay.
Yes.
Perfect. Now, Jan, I was just saying that there's a lady in the side chat whose brother wrote the book Die Groot Krokodil. Now, that was the book about P.W. Botha, but perhaps you'd like to just sort of say hi in case her brother is sitting there with her.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Good to hear that somebody who knew him is in the audience. That's excellent.
Now, Jan, Botha and his wife Elise retired to their home, Die Anker, in the town of Wilderness, 16 kilometers from the city of George, and located on the Indian Ocean coast on the Western Cape. That's where you first actually met P.W. You were fishing, weren't you, or something like that, and he walked up to you. So tell us what happened.
No, it's actually very different. Ah. No, what happened was I was running my African Crisis website, and I'd been running it since 2001. And in the year 2000, I was working on my book, Government by Deception, which was my warning to the whites of South Africa. So my website took a while to get going, and it took a lot of heat, I must tell you. And by about 2006, I began to hear from people that PW's wife was active on the internet, because his first wife died, and he married another woman named Barbara.
Right.
So we began to hear that Barbara Botha is on the internet. So at a point, I decided, let me just try and take a chance and see if we can get hold of her email address. And we managed to do that. And then I wrote her an email and I asked her if I could send PW a copy of Government by Deception. So I sent off the copy of Government by Deception with a covering letter or whatever. And to be honest with you, I never really expected to hear anything from them, because one of the problems that I always suffered from, apart from specific military contacts that I had, on the whole, Rhodesians and South Africans who were politicians or people in high places or people of note, never came and responded to me or wanted to deal with me in public. So I didn't expect to hear anything further. But the next thing was that I got an email from her, and she said that PW liked the book and so forth. And then what happened was she phoned me the one day, and this was in April of 2006. I knew him from April until he died, which was, I think, near the end of October. But anyway, she phoned me and she said that he liked my book and everything's nice and so forth. And then she said, you know, he's here, he'd like to talk to you. So he spoke to me for a few minutes, said hi, etc. And that was really awesome for me. Anyway, I went and I mentioned this on my website, and she was friendly and she was writing stuff back. And then one day he phoned me to talk to me specifically about a topic. And we must have talked for an hour. And I went and grabbed a notebook and I started making notes. And then I wrote it down and I wrote it up on my website and so forth. And when I published it, I sent the link to his wife. She was the one who was active on the internet. And what she did was she would print the stuff out, because he was 90 years old. So she would print the stuff out and give it to him and he'd read it. And in the day, he'd sit in his chair by the window and he would read things. Anyway, he liked the fact that I wrote exactly what he said. That I didn't take journalist license, I didn't twist things, I just wrote the facts. And then he started phoning me more and more. And he would phone me, and then he'd phone again for like an hour, and we'd talk, and I'd make notes, and I'd write it on my website, and I'd publish it, and I'd send a copy to his wife, and he'd check it, and so it went on. And then after this had gone on for quite some time, I then got a request from her saying that they'd like to invite me to their house. So they invited me to their house for October, and we sort of planned the whole thing, hush, hush, etc. And there were some strange things that started happening. Like just a week before I went to his house, all of a sudden there was a medical emergency, and suddenly they rushed him to the hospital saying that he might have some kind of heart problem, and it was all over the news. And then he came back after spending like a day or two in the hospital. It was on a weekend. And then he came back and they said, no, all was well. And I came about the next week. I think it was the very next week I ended up there. So we planned it and I stayed there for 5 days. And in those 5 days, we had a bunch of further discussions. I took photos while I was there, and I also made notes. In fact, I'm sitting with my notes. I've got about 16 pages of notes that I made while I was there at his place talking to him. So the other thing also.
Yeah, carry on.
The other thing I also want to mention to you is all of this is due to you doing these interviews with me. I began to think that we're talking to a South African audience, got a lot of Boers in the audience, and I began to think that I really need to pull out my archives so that I can pull out the old data so that I can go through various things like this with you. And in the last month, I actually pulled out my archive, which I haven't looked at in over a decade. I managed to recover from my database 110,000 articles.
Wow.
That is the total number of articles I had on my original website. My current African crisis only has 3,900 articles on, and my history review's got 24,000. But my original African crisis, 110,000 articles with lots of stuff there. And I was actually, I spent the last couple of weeks pulling it out and beginning to start searching and looking around so that I could start checking dates and checking articles, because there's a bunch of stuff that I think you will find useful on your show for your audience. And the very first thing I wanted to tackle was P.W. Botha. So I will also be trying to get my 110,000 articles back on the internet so people can search it. Because while looking through the stuff, I was checking things I wrote, links I had, etc. And I want to tell you that most of the websites that I was linking to no longer exist. There were Afrikaans websites, there were all kinds of websites that I was dealing with, and I used to publish articles, but luckily I came up with the strategy early on that I never just post links, because websites might disappear, and boy did that work out to be the better way to go. Yeah. I've got tens of thousands of articles from websites that no longer exist.
Yeah. Look, I know exactly what you're talking about. My gwb.com.au domain dates back to 1995. That's nearly 30 years, and I can tell you now an enormous amount of the links in the old articles I wrote are gone. You know, they just, page does not exist. Now, that's a tyranny of the internet, and we had a tyranny earlier today where the entire Loving Life website was taken down. We just talked about that, and I do apologize for the delay on bringing you on, but people need to know what happened. Now let's get back to P.W. Botha, and I want to talk specifically about his role as the Minister of Defense, because he was the Minister of Defense for a long time. And under him, South Africa, or the South African Defense Force, reached its zenith. I mean, it had the most powerful army, the most powerful navy, the most powerful air force. The weapons they were developing in South Africa, under the now completely stuffed, Denel, that's it, yeah. I mean, but what they were producing was amazing. And under Botha, they also manufactured 6 nuclear weapons. Now, the story is that those were they were taken apart in the late 1990s. Were they actually destroyed? Do you know? Did he talk to you about them?
Yes, he did discuss that. And yes, they were destroyed. They were actually destroyed at the request of the CIA. The CIA actually did not want the nuclear weapons to fall into the hands of the ANC, can you believe? So that is the actual reason why they were destroyed. The SADF, his Minister of Defense role, that is the time of his life that he himself said he enjoyed the most. And he is actually responsible literally for the SADF becoming the awesome machine that it became.
Yeah.
I must tell you that in South Africa, the first automatic military rifle that came out of South Africa was the R1. And the R1 was based on the Belgian FN rifle, which was the rifle for NATO. And that process actually started in the 1960s already under Verwoerd. And so anyway, in PW's time, they built up the SADF. I recall PW Botha coming to Rhodesia and wanting to help the Rhodesians. in our final days. Unfortunately, by then it was too late, but he was very friendly and we liked him. But he was very proud of that time in the SADF. And later on, I also read that he authorized the use of the Olifant tanks in Angola. And at a point when the generals were battling up there, he even chided them and said to them, but I've given you guys authorization. You can use the tanks anytime you want. So he was very proud of his time in the SADF. And he even at a point mentioned to me that he felt that the SADF was more than capable of taking on the Russians.
Wow.
He was very proud of the SADF, really. Yes, well, he was very proud of it.
Well, I mean, the ANC never, ever fought the SADF. They were sitting in the background. But that is true.
Exactly.
Now, just while we're talking about the military aspect, did PW ever discuss any of the generals in the South African Defence Force?
Yes, he did talk about various generals. One guy who was his good friend was General Constant Viljoen, and Constant Viljoen would phone him, would come and visit him quite regularly, etc. He told me that I think Constant Viljoen and Nelson Mandela pitched up there one day talking to him. I'm not sure if that was the discussion when Nelson Mandela asked him to return to politics. But there was a visit by Nelson Mandela where Mandela specifically requested that P.W. Botha return to politics and return to leading the National Party. Can you believe? This is after de Klerk. And that in and of itself is a very interesting thing. One of the things that P.W. Botha told me about Constant Viljoen is that at a point, this is the point where Constant Viljoen went off and created, the Freedom Front. P.W. Botha said to me that he told Constant Viljoen not to create a political party, but to create a cultural organization. He didn't define it more broadly than that. And, you know, there are a bunch of things that I must tell you. In my discussions with P.W. Botha, there are many things where only in later years did I manage to truly grasp some of the stuff he was trying to tell me, because he told me all sorts of things, some of which just went over my head. And later on, when I dug into history more, then suddenly the penny would drop, like with the Portuguese. There were things he told me about the Portuguese and so forth that didn't quite make sense. And then later I realized, this must be what he was meaning. So he didn't define clearly what he meant by a cultural organization. But I think what he was out to do was he wanted the Boere to basically stick together and to not give up on their culture or their language or anything. And in fact, at the end of this interview, I've got another surprise for you. I've got the very last interview that P.W. Botha ever gave to any journalists, and I'm going to release it on my website immediately after this, and I'll send you and Natalie and Marlena the links.
Fantastic.
And you can listen to his very last interview done in January 2006.
Yeah, well,
I think you're going to be in for some surprises.
We'll put that underneath the video in the description. And just don't let your website go down, or it'll be another one of those links that says no page or something.
Don't joke with me like that, Scott. I must tell you, I myself got an email this week that is unsettling me in a big way.
What was it?
Very worried about my own websites. I got an email from the hosting company, and there have been changes at the hosting company, and there are new owners. And I must tell you, I've had my websites taken down before, and this hosting company is known for its freedom of speech. And I'm actually very worried as to whether the new owners are going to change policies, because I saw this happening on that video website Rumble. Rumble was recently bought out as well, and immediately they banned my channel and they started banning people. So I'm actually very worried, because my website's been taken down several times, not just by hackers, but by hosting companies just shutting them down. And so I'm going to start with immediate effect looking for new places to host, because my setup is quite complicated, and if I can even find somebody who will host it, it could take me weeks to set up my stuff. I'm very, very concerned that this is the beginning of the end on this particular hosting company.
Yeah, well,
so I'm actually quite depressed about it, actually.
Jan, I'll put you in touch with Rudy and with Gareth. They're both Gareth, I believe, has got a hosting company. He's someone who works on Lovey Life TV. And Rudy can probably give you advice on where to get a new host, because what's happening now is the censorship taking place on the internet is becoming absolutely extreme. Okay, let's just get back to to P.W. Burton. Carry on.
And the other general I must mention is General Constant Viljoen. Sorry, not Constant Viljoen. I meant Magnus Malan. Sorry. Magnus Malan, who was the head of the SADF, he also used to phone Magnus Malan. Magnus Malan would phone him as well. Sometimes they would chat while I was sitting in the lounge. He'd be on the phone to him. But at the time that I visited, Magnus Malan's book had just come out in English and Afrikaans. And P.W. Buerto was looking through Magnus Malan's book, reading various parts of it, and he was saying to me, man, this book is good. He says, this book is good, and this book tells the truth. And he would phone Magnus Malan, and he'd praise him over the book. And then P.W. Buerto said something. He said, this book, Magnus Malan's book, is going to cause a stir. But unfortunately, P.W. Buerto did not realize how bad the liberal mass media really is. And if they don't like something, they don't even publish a word about it.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the stir that he predicted never took place, because the liberals don't mention Magnus Malan's book. But he told me that everything in Magnus Malan's book is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So he loved it.
Right. Now, you mentioned about the cultural side that P.W. Buerto was trying to bring into South Africa. Earlier, he had been looking at setting up a tricameral parliament with a white-only House of Assembly. The House of Representatives would be for coloureds, and the House of Delegates for the Indian population. And, of course, for the various Bantu ethnic groups, they would have Bantu stands. Now, the three chambers of the tricameral parliament had sole jurisdiction over matters relating to their respective communities. What happened to that idea that he had?
To be honest with you, I never really dug into the tricameral parliament and those things. All I can tell you is that P.W. Buerto did take pride in the fact that he was responsible for reform in South Africa. But one of the things you must be careful about regarding P.W. Buerto is that in the 1980s, when he was the prime minister, and he changed it from prime minister to president as well.
Right.
When he was the president, during that time, that is when South Africa got lots of heat. You know, if the 70s was the time of the heat for Rhodesia, the 80s was the time of heat for South Africa.
Yes.
And in that that video that you will see, P.W. Buerto talks about a concept called the total onslaught. And that total onslaught is something that I think the white South Africans do not fully appreciate. And the leaders themselves, including PW, did not fully describe and warn the people of how bad the pressure is against South Africa. So there was tremendous pressure. And in that interview, PW Botha says that the enemies of South Africa were the communists, the Soviet Union, Cuba, and their allies, which of course included China and the Warsaw Pact. Mm. But he also said some Western nations. But he never tells you which Western nations are our enemies. So there were some Western nations that were openly hostile to us, but we who live here were never told things like, oh, Britain or Sweden, or, you know, that European country is actually at war with us. Those things were never told to us. So you got to understand there's this thing called the total onslaught. It's more than just the terrorist war. The ANC is being assisted by other countries, including right. Western countries. And so PW Botha was under a lot of pressure to do reform. So he's proud that he did reform, and yes, he was responsible for giving the coloureds the vote and the Indians the vote and giving them the ability to start dealing with their affairs. But never at any time was he going to just hand the country over to the blacks, especially yeah. the ANC. And one of the things that PW Botha made clear is that he actually – I think when Nelson Mandela was in jail, Nelson Mandela at one point asked to meet PW Botha, and he allowed him to. And he told Nelson Mandela that he would let him out of jail on one condition. He must in public renounce violence. And Nelson Mandela never renounced violence. And that is why PW Botha never let him out of jail. But F.W. de Klerk did. So that is where P.W. Botha is different. P.W. Botha tried to retain white power as much as he could while sort of quietly introducing things like capitalism. Like, I don't know if you know, but P.W. Botha is responsible for the black taxi industry. He's actually the guy who created the black taxi industry in South Africa. He instituted that thing under apartheid, and he allowed blacks to own taxis. They went and they dug into the issue of what would work for them, and it was whites who came up with the idea that these minibus taxis would work. When the black taxi thing was created, or the industry was created, only black people were allowed to own those taxis. But I know from that time that secretly whites and blacks were owning taxi organizations in violation of the fact that whites were not supposed to own yeah. own taxis. But the taxi industry in South Africa, which I think then spread to the rest of Africa, is a creation by P.W. Botha. He did various things, and all the things he did fell into the concept of, which we will discuss as time further on, his idea of what he called a confederal system. P.W. Botha never believed in a single country run from a central government. He did not believe in that, and there was no ways he was going to do that. He believed in splitting up the country into what he called a confederal system,
yes,
the same as Switzerland and Belgium.
Right.
And then in there, all the different groups would have their pieces of territory, their parliaments, etc. Mm. So what he did with the Indians and the coloureds was probably the beginning of that.
Yeah. So
in
the same way that
the homelands were the beginning of that.
What we're saying, Jan, it's rather like the European Union of today, where you've got like a central government, but you've got independent states within that country.
Yes, it's like America, before the Civil War, that was also functioning on a confederal system. In America, the term they use is states' rights. A state had more rights than the central government, and that's how it used to be. A state can override the central government, and P.W. Botha believed that that sort of system, in that system, the whites, especially the Boere, would be fitting somewhere in that system. They would have their state too.
Now, I think it was P.W. Botha who famously is on record of saying that South Africa would never prosper under a black government. He said they would be incapable of running a country like South Africa. I might be wrong with that. But did P.W. Botha ever say... Sorry, carry on.
No, finish, just finish.
Okay. Did P.W. Botha ever say anything about Nelson Mandela or any of the other black presidents of South Africa? But yeah, just over to you.
Okay. Yes. He spoke quite a bit about Mandela, and it's very interesting. You know, again, if you look at F.W. de Klerk, the guy who gave the blacks everything on a plate, the guy who just threw the country into the rubbish bin without even attempting to stop it. If you look at him, you would think that the blacks would like F.W. de Klerk more than P.W. Botha. But in actual fact, the blacks, especially Mandela, seem to have much more of a respect for him. I don't think Mandela liked him, but Mandela treated him with respect in a way that very possibly F.W. de Klerk was never treated. For example, he told me that Mandela came to visit him at his house twice, and at his house, Die Anker, he had a guest book, and he opened the guest book and he showed me Nelson Mandela's signature. Nelson Mandela's got quite a nice signature, actually.
Yeah.
And he told me also that Nelson, as I've mentioned, Nelson Mandela asked him to come back into politics and to lead the National Party. This is, I think, after, I'm not sure what year this was, but he later also said that Nelson Mandela once was in Mozambique, and he phoned him from Mozambique, and he thanked him for what he did for Mozambique, because P.W. Botha actually stopped the war in Mozambique. Something that I differ on, it's a topic for another day, but I did discuss this with him, and yeah, Mandela thanked him for what he did in Mozambique, because the Nkomati Accord actually stopped South Africa and RENAMO from waging a war in Mozambique. Now, another thing about Mandela that he said to me on more than one occasion, he said to me that he had face-to-face discussions with Mandela in his house, and that as far as he's concerned, Nelson Mandela is a communist and he is a terrorist. And he made that quite clear. He spoke about Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki was the guy that the liberals loved to bits after Mandela was the president. But I personally detested Mbeki. Mbeki started out as quite anti-white, and he later toned down his statements. And what many whites don't know is that Mbeki is responsible for allowing Robert Mugabe to get away with the total destruction of the whites of Zimbabwe. Oh. Mbeki was an evil, evil bastard of a man. I hated him. If they tell you that Zuma was worse or this or that, let me tell you, these ANC leaders, the one is the same as the other one, hey?
Yeah.
Mbeki was a snake. But anyway, P.W. Botha said that he'd never met Mbeki himself, but he said that from his assessment of Mbeki, that Mbeki was also a communist. And another point that P.W. made was that neither Mandela nor Mbeki or any of the ANC leaders ever tell the black people to stay away from communism. They never tell the blacks that.
Yeah.
And so he reckons the ANC is a communist organization.
Right. Now, It's interesting you say that Thabo Mbeki was a snake, because another snake was clearly F.W. de Klerk. And F.W. de Klerk had this to say about P.W. Botha, and I'll just quote. He says, "Personally, my relationship with P.W. Botha was often strained. I did not like his overbearing leadership style and was opposed to the intrusion of the State Security Council system into virtually every facet of government. After I became leader of the National Party in February 1989, I did my best to ensure that P.W. Botha would be able to end his term as president with full dignity and decorum. Unfortunately, this was not to be." What's your response to that?
Oh man, there's a ton of stuff there. Okay, let me tell you a little bit of history here, because there are some videos that I went and found, and I will put them out. Let me tell you, P.W. Botha was the president. He was doing his thing, and then all of a sudden, a bunch of strange things started happening, and he appeared on TV. As I recall from memory, he appeared on TV twice. The first time he appeared on TV, he said something like, people in his cabinet have come to him and told him to resign. They've told him to resign over his health. And he said that, no, there's nothing wrong with his health, and no, he's not going to resign. And then a short while after that, suddenly he's rushed to hospital or something. And there is a health scare that relating
just,
to him.
Just to interrupt you for a second there, Jan. On the 18th of January, 1989, P.W. Botha, then aged 73, suffered a mild stroke, which prevented him from attending a meeting with Namibian political leaders. On the 20th of January, 1989. Back to you.
That's probably the incident we're talking about. Right, so after he'd been talking about his health, then suddenly later he has this sudden health problem. And then he goes onto TV after some time, and he tells people that, and there's this little piece is available. I downloaded it the other day. And he tells people that members of his cabinet are like no longer listening to him. People are sort of ignoring him, and that, you know, if people aren't carrying out his orders, then, you know, they're basically rebelling against him. And in there, he even mentions something. He mentions something about F.W. de Klerk and P.W. Botha going to Britain. And so there are things that start happening where F.W. de Klerk and P.W. Botha start ignoring him and doing their own thing. And there's also another instance. There was an article I think I published on my website. There was another instance where another minister in the government, I don't know his name, but there was another minister who suddenly resigned, and he said that he's resigning because there's all kinds of like infighting. There was an Afrikaans word he used for it. I can't remember the exact term. But let me tell you, before F.W. de Klerk came to be president, there was some kind of nonsense that they were busy with among the other whites. And another thing that I saw in my notes, in my discussions with P.W., and I think this might come from, I'm not sure if the source is General Malan, but apparently F.W. de Klerk also went to Russia. And after he'd been to Russia, he came back and he changed his policies. Another thing that F.W. de Klerk did was he went to America, and he gave a talk or a news conference in front of the cameras with the first President Bush, President Bush Senior.
Right.
In front of the cameras with Bush Senior. premier, he stands there and he says, the negotiation process in South Africa is irreversible. All of a sudden, the process is irreversible. Meanwhile, if you look at the things that F.W. de Klerk had told the whites when they were doing the referendum had been about do we carry on with negotiations? Because F.W. de Klerk originally said that this is power sharing. This is not a handover. But as the years go by, suddenly it becomes a handover. But the whites aren't asked about that. And the turning point seems to be this visit to President Bush. So he went to Britain. He went and Britain, I don't think, is friendly to the Boers. He went to Britain. He went to Russia. He went to America. He was doing all kinds of things. So F.W. de Klerk was busy with all kinds of other nonsense that white South Africans didn't know about, and he probably never told them what really went on in those discussions. I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff there. There is one thing I must mention in my notes. P.W. Botha told me that at a point F.W. de Klerk visited him, I think, more than once, but he told me that on the one visit, he took F.W. de Klerk on over the handing over of the country. And he told F.W. that the reason he handed over the country was that he was being paid off to do this. He specifically cited the Nobel Peace Prize. He specifically mentioned the Jewish organization, B'nai B'rith. But he said to me, if I remember correctly, I'll double check in my notes, but as I understand it, that particular discussion that he had with F.W. in his house, it was recorded.
Wow.
So somewhere, somebody has got that recording.
Wow. Wouldn't that
would be a bombshell. It's what he told F.W. de Klerk, and that exists somewhere.
Wow, I'd love to know where that is. Now, just talk, you mentioned Pik Botha, and his name keeps on coming up. I believe he was South Africa's Henry Kissinger, basically just a stooge for the New World Order. What are your thoughts about Pik Botha?
Oh, man, Pik Botha. I originally, when I was younger and I saw Pik Botha on the TV, he used to come to Rhodesia and talk to us. And then I saw him in South Africa when I lived in South Africa. I liked Pik Botha. I thought he was a very personable guy. He was very, very good. And I liked him. I thought he was a great guy. But I will tell you where my viewpoint of Pik Botha started changing was when I was doing research for Government by Deception and I started talking to former military officers.
Yeah.
Former military officers. Oh, man. And the guy who gave me the most dirt on Pik Botha was General Tini Groenewald. Tini Groenewald absolutely detested Pik Botha. He regarded him as garbage. He told me that that Pik Botha sold out every single secret that South Africa had.
Wow.
He said Pik Botha would sell South Africa's secrets to anybody, even to the Russians. There was nobody that Pik Botha would not sell the secrets to. And I'll tell you something more about P.W. and Tini Groenewald. P.W. told me that the head of the CIA at the time, a guy named Casey, I think it's C-A-S-E-Y, Casey. Casey came to South Africa and met with P.W. Botha. Casey told P.W., he said, we Americans, we don't know enough about Africa, you know, and, you know, we'll be turning to you guys for advice. P.W. said he really liked Casey. He said Casey was also a staunch guy, etc. So he liked the head of the CIA. Now, General Tini Groenewald told me that he also met the head of the CIA, and I'm assuming that it's the same guy, that it's also Casey, because I don't think Tini Groenewald named the guy. But Tini Groeneval told me that the head of the CIA told him that in all the CIA operations in the whole world, they had never come across a guy as corrupt as Pip Botha.
Wow.
He said, that guy is dirt. So, you know, all the things that went on there. You know, this is why I keep saying to people, when I read books, when I talk to people and the various things, and even my discussions with PW, I must tell you that there are so many things that I think are hidden. I think that 90% of the real politics of what went on in this country in the 1980s was never really told. And the leaders would only say like very mild things. It's, oh, you know, we're sitting in a situation of total war. And then the liberal mass media, the backstabbing, anti-Boer, anti-government liberal mass media in South Africa, that all mocked this kind of stuff. Oh, what are you talking about? What's happening? There's nothing. You're just making this stuff up. You people in the National Party are just inventing this stuff. No, I think the National Party told a lot of truth. And I think that they didn't even tell people the full horror of things that were really going on. But ultimately, as I see it, the pressure was put on the leaders. The leaders were broken down. And of course, coming back to why did PW have to leave? Well, PW would never, never have handed over the country to the blacks. And it is very clear. And you said, for example, that PW said the blacks wouldn't be able to
govern a country,
wouldn't be able to run the country. Yeah. I have seen a similar quote. In fact, I've got a screenshot from the social media where a black person quotes PW Botha and says, actually, we've been unable to prove him wrong. He has been right. Actually, we can't run the country. So
I've actually got that video clip.
Ah, nice. I would like to get a copy of it, if I may.
Absolutely. I'll just have to dig it up. But, PW Botha talking and saying that, you know, you're crazy to hand the country over to a black government. Now, carry on. Back to
if I may just my apologies. So as I see it, the pressure on South Africa was growing, and they were trying to break the politicians.
Yeah.
And they were trying to get PW to hand over the country to the blacks, but he refused.
Right.
He made reforms, he made changes, but he never was going to hand over to the communist terrorist Nelson Mandela. And the other thing also about the state security services is that, you know, the state, and that includes the South African police, I must tell you, because remember there were the police, the security police, all of these organizations were Afrikaner dominated. And they were keeping us safe in our beds at night, okay? And this business of the state security sticking their nose into all affairs, I think that PW Botha was doing the right thing. In fact, when that disgusting two-faced snake, FW, came and gave away the country, one of the first things he did was he fired generals. He was firing generals left, right, and center, including even a police general. He actually engaged in a purge of the generals. So, you know, if the top politician comes, he fires all the generals, then you've got to ask yourself, why is he firing these generals? And, of course, the reason is he's doing a purge of the generals because the generals are going to refuse to do what he they're going to refuse to carry out his orders.
Yeah,
you know. So it's so yeah.
If we go,
so I think that they had to get rid of PW.
Yeah.
They had to get rid of PW because that was the only way that they could get this country to be handed over. And that's very important, we, you know, that that whatever PW's faults, he wasn't disloyal and he did not betray the whites. Never.
Yeah. And in fact, back in 1982, the reforms that P.W. Botha brought in went too far for a group of National Party hardliners like Education Minister Andries Troenicht, who then basically broke away to form the Conservative Party. Those must have been pretty traumatic times for P.W. Botha because, you know, here he was trying to move in the direction that would appease the rest of the world, and now you've got part of his party setting up an alternative Conservative Party. Do you want to take us through that period?
Yeah, interestingly enough, I actually liked Troenicht. And I actually even wrote a letter to Andries Troenicht. And he replied to me, I need to hunt through my archives, my physical archives, because he wrote a very nice reply. I actually supported the more hardcore stance. You see, one of the things you've got to be careful of, Scott, is that when the whites are put under pressure to start making changes, this is true for Rhodesia as well, okay? And Ian Smith used to warn about this. Ian Smith used to talk about what he called the slippery slope of appeasement.
Yeah.
So once you start going down that path where you start changing the country's laws, you got to be careful because as you change it, you might get to a point of no return where you lose control of everything. So P.W. Botha was willing to engage in change up to a point, but there was a point where he was still digging his heels in. And so he like never let Mandela out of jail. And he also refused to unban the ANC. Whereas those are the things that de Klerk did, you see. But as PW was beginning to do his reform, you did get people who were harder core. And I fell into that because I was concerned that any move that weakens white power is bad. So I quite liked the Conservative Party, but Troenicht died. I think Troenicht died, and that was pretty much the end of the Conservative Party. You also had the AWB. The AWB was also becoming very strong because the AWB, I have a soft spot for the AWB. The AWB represents the poorer whites. It represents the poorer Afrikaans whites. And they showed that they were willing to fight the blacks. So you have the National Party that is now under a lot of pressure and it's starting to move. But the question is, how far will it move? And it's starting to stress other whites. You also have the HNP, the one political party that I will tell you that I have unbelievable respect for now with time is the HNP. The HNP is the one political party that told the whites the truth all along and nobody listened. But the HNP, the AWB, the Conservatives, as PW was reforming, all these other whites were starting to kick off. And you had guys like, who's that guy who went and shot Chris Hani? You had all those blokes starting to become hardcore as these whites are realizing that, you know, we got to get ready for a fight. Mm. And so it becomes a tricky thing. It's not a pretty thing. So now the whites are also split, okay? The whites are split. And ultimately, I must tell you, the white right is actually always correct, ultimately. And unfortunately, when the National Party started giving way, then you also had the National Party sort of controlling the AWB so that the AWB doesn't take over. It's a miserable thing. But out of this miserable thing, I think PW did as good as he could. You can't fault him. He never actually handed over the country, and the military power of South Africa right to the end was very powerful, including the police. They were very, very effective. The handover of South Africa is a thing that is a 100% F.W. de Klerk thing. End of story. They broke the National Party. The weaklings took over, and they kicked P.W. out.
Yeah, well, Eugene,
in order to hand over,
Eugene de Blanche obviously headed up the RVAB. And P met a very untimely death on his farm. That was very, very sad what happened there. I mean, I really think that in many ways he symbolized hope for the largely the Boer population in South Africa. And once he was taken out, I think a lot of the wind went out of the sails of the resistance against what was happening. What are your thoughts about that?
Definitely, definitely. Eugene de Blanche, you know, if P.W. Botha was one level of resistance, Eugene de Blanche was the real grassroots resistance. People who were in the AWB told me that at the peak of its power, it had 900,000 members.
Wow.
900,000. It was freaking huge. You know, the AWB had the ability to be what you could call a militia army that would have gone and fought the blacks, man. And I mean, there were whites, lower class whites, men and women, man, who were willing to just take on these blacks and fight the blacks, you know, with their weapons themselves.
Yeah.
And you know, they got nothing but a bad rap all the time from all these wise asses in politics, whereas they represented the real thing. In my African Crisis archives, I will find and return to you with more stuff about the death of Eugene de Blanche. I have serious issues with the death of Eugene de Blanche. I will tell you, in my personal view, it was not an accident. It was an assassination, and I will tell you who I believe was behind the death of Eugene de Blanche. But let me go dig into my archives. Right. I'll come back to you.
Right. Okay. Now, the other side of this, which we haven't touched on, is the Broederbond. Now, P.W. Botha was very involved in the Broederbond, but then left it near the end. Why did he leave the Broederbond?
I don't recall him telling me why. I think, I'm not sure if he implied that they were becoming corrupt or something. There was something, but I will have to check further in my notes if he said anything. Offhand, I can't remember any particular reason why. I'm not negative in my view of the Broederbond, but then again, I've only read one book about it, and that's the book that was published in the 1970s by the liberals, and they called it the Super Afrikaners. And this was the liberals exposing the secret power behind the National Party. And I quite liked the gist of the story that I got out of that, though I'd like to actually check some other documentaries and things later to look more into it. But my understanding of the Broederbond is that the Broederbond originally was started after the Second Anglo-Boer War, that a lot of these Boers were then trying to figure out how are they going to get some kind of power and how can they defend themselves. Mm. You see, what people don't realize is that when the British conquered South Africa, the Boers became second-rate citizens. The Boers were actually discriminated against by the English. Okay, in South Africa, I had an uncle on my mother's side. I had an uncle who told me, I think it was in the 1920s or sometime, not sure if it's 1920s, 1930s. He told me he was trying to get into business. And he said to me, if you were Afrikaans, you were not allowed into business. So business was dominated by English-speaking people.
people. So the Boere basically, all the Afrikaans speakers, so the Boere basically formed, and it could be the people they refer to as the Boere and the Cape Dutch. I'm not going to go into that, but let's say all the Afrikaans speakers came to realize that they need to form organizations. And they basically started building their own organizations that were duplicates of everything that the English had. So what they did was they built their own banks. They started their own banks, Volkskas. The original one being Volkskas. They started their own insurance companies, Sanlam. They started their own media organizations. They started their own boys organization, the Voortrekkers. They started that. They started cultural organizations and everything so that Afrikaans people could do business with other Afrikaans people, support their own banks. And ultimately, the big creation out of this was the National Party. So the national, you must understand that under General Smuts, South Africa was very liberal. And the National Party came along and it was Afrikaans dominated and it was very racist. And it came to bring back nationalism. And they actually set out to unite all whites and to make South Africa a racial creation. And the big event was the victory in 1948 when the National Party came to power.
Yeah.
Sent shockwaves through the liberal and communist ranks. So the Broederbond was responsible. The Broederbond infiltrated everything. The Broederbond infiltrated the police, infiltrated the army, infiltrated everything. So the things they couldn't create duplicates of, they infiltrated them until they got people to the top. And so they took over all of South Africa. These Afrikaans people took over South Africa. And the Broederbond drove all of this. So the Broederbond drove the National Party. The Broederbond drove the media, the banks, everything. And so I see the Broederbond as the rise of the Boers and the Afrikaners in taking over South Africa and grabbing it away from the British.
Right.
And grabbing it away from them. And they created the policy of apartheid. Though later you'll see even P.W. Botha ducks and dives on the issue of apartheid. But I don't see the Broederbond as a bad thing. I think what happened, I will finish shortly. I think what happened is that the Broederbond itself became infiltrated and corrupted.
Yeah.
And later it broke up. And it went some other path. It still exists. It's called the Afrikaner Bond. And you know, they should have tons of money. That they had hundreds of millions of rands back then already.
Yeah.
They were moving money. They may be worth many billions. So they still exist. And the question is, what things do they still control?
Right.
Possibly AfriForum and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they're still around. They're there.
Okay, well, it's interesting because when I worked at the bank in Escort, this is back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, a farmer moved into the district. He actually bought huge maize farms between the Drakensberg and Escort, which is a fantastic farming area. And he was planting maize and he had all this maize. And we were told in the bank, he was a client of Barclays Bank, which is now, I think, First National Bank. But he was a client of our branch. And before he even came in, we were warned that he was a senior member of the Broederbond and that he should be treated with utmost respect. We were warned by our head office. And when this guy came into the branch, you know, you said, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, because he was the senior member of the Broederbond. And he literally bought all these farms. I don't know where he got the cash, but, you know, I guess that was part of being a senior member of the Broederbond.
Yeah, it was Afrikaans power. You can say the Brüderbund was the Freemasons of the Boer Afrikaners.
Yeah,
the Brüderbund. That's true. And in the Super Afrikaners, they published the names of 10,000 of the members. And in there, you will see lots of those same politicians. Lots of the politicians in the National Party were members of the Brüderbund. So, you know, in many ways, this is like terrorism, for example. I don't want to attack the Brüderbund, because in a world of secret societies, and if you go and you look at the creation of the United States, the United States, the founding fathers of America were mostly Freemasons, okay? Yeah. And their Freemason stuff sits on the American dollar bills to this day.
Yeah.
You know, the all-seeing eye, the pyramid, all that. So it was Freemasons who created America. And I think that in a world of secrecy and secret organizations, that the only way that any group of people can fight back is to form your own secret society. Because a secret society has got certain advantages. There are things that the secret society can do that allow that they can succeed at, and the concept works. So the only way for the Boer Afrikaners to regain control of South Africa is form their secret society, form their political party, etc. In the same way that the blacks went and formed their political party to save them, you know. And, you know, it's also like terrorism in the sense that if you are a terrorist and you function in a certain way, you've got certain advantages. There are certain things terrorists can do that make it almost impossible to fight them. And ultimately, in any battle, you've got to go down. There's a term that says the low man determines the fight.
Right.
So in other words, if somebody's got dirtier tricks than you and they beat you because of their dirty tricks, you eventually have to go down to their level and fight them on their level. So I don't want to knock these people because they're trying to survive. And ultimately the National Party and the Brüderbund was racist, and it kept South Africa white, and it gave white power. And it also brought about white unity. It united the whites.
Yeah.
And I mean, so I don't want to knock them. You know, I'm a defender of apartheid, actually.
Right.
I defend it. I think they were doing what they could.
Yeah.
Blacks do the same thing when they get a chance. Make no mistake.
Yeah. Well, what's happening in South Africa now is like a bad marriage. It's just, you know, going absolutely crazy. Now, just getting back to PW and your stay at his place, was there any particularly interesting things you saw at his house? And how was his health? Because the media suggested he was senile at this time.
Yes, you see, let's start with his health. Again, before I went to PW Buerta, the mass media, the lying mass media,
yeah,
man, the mass
fake
media
news
are nothing but a propaganda organization. The mass media was saying things like, oh, you know, PW Buerta, he's senile. They probably were trying to find excuses for reasons to not interview him. So they'd say things like, oh, he's senile, he's lost his mind, etc. When I started speaking to him, I realized, no, there's nothing wrong with his mind. In fact, his mind is sharp. And when I was at his house, and I mean, every meal I had was with him and his wife. And when I was at his house, I had breakfast, lunch, and supper with them. He would even start cracking jokes. He'd start telling jokes and things. And his mind was fully active. He was phoning people. He would talk to me. He would talk to other people on the phone. I could listen to him talking to others, and he's absolutely fine. In fact, to give you an idea of how two-faced the mass media is, and I caught them out a bit, was just before I arrived at his place, because I flew down, about a day or two before I left, his wife phoned me, and she told me that somebody in one of the Afrikaans media organizations in the Rapport, in the newspaper Rapport, she told me that somebody at Rapport told her that there is an order at Rapport that all the journalists have been told they must never do stories about P.W. Botha. So I went on to African Crisis, and at that time I had quite an audience, and I published what she said. And I kid you not, when in the next few days, by the time I got to him, I'd been there like 2 days, and a Rapport suddenly phones him and says, oh, we want to send a journalist and over to come and see you. And when I was there, the very next day, the journalist arrived, a nice, attractive female Afrikaans journalist and a white male cameraman. They arrived there, and I was sitting inside his lounge looking through the glass window as the Rapport people were busy interviewing him, and they were all friendly and they were busy talking. Oh, PW, how are things going with you? And afterwards they went back and they wrote a lovely story about it, etc. All during that time, bunch of two-faced snakes.
Yeah, I seem to remember... So, at some time during the last 20 years in South Africa, the media actually pointed their finger at you and called you all sorts of terrible things. But that's a story for another day. Because, look, the same thing has happened to me here in Australia. And we know how they work. They love labeling people who don't fit their copybook. I mean, they're just absolute fake. Now, let's get back to... comment that Marlena made.
I'm not finished. Can I finish?
Yeah, please go ahead. You know, just before you do.
Okay, so that is one thing.
Just before you do, I just want to tell you what Marlena said, which is interesting. She said, Andries Treurnicht was my mother's uncle on her mother's side. Now, that's just a tidbit of information. Okay, back to you.
Oh, wow. Nice. Okay, the other thing that other things, I went around his house, he showed me his various things, and he also took me to his actual office, and he had his office with his library, but he didn't go there often. I've got a photograph in his office. On his desk was the apartheid flag, which is now illegal in South Africa, but I've got a photo of it. That flag was on his desk. And he had an interesting exercise bicycle, etc. But while I was looking through his library, I came across a little book on nuclear weapons. And I asked him if I could borrow the little book. And I borrowed it, and during the 5 days that I was there, I read through the little book. Unfortunately, I never photographed it or anything like that, and I could really kick myself with regard to it.
Yeah.
The little book was the most interesting thing I saw. It was a little white book. It was round about 100 or so pages, 100 or a bit more than 100 pages long. The little book, there were only 250 copies of the little book.
Wow.
The book, I can't remember the title. The book was written by the people who did the nuclear weapons program of South Africa.
Wow.
And it only 250 copies were printed, and they were autographed and given to specific people, P.W. Botha being one of them. And I read through this little book. It had pictures, etc. And I want to tell you, it blew my mind. In a nutshell, can you believe that South Africa's entire nuclear industry, including the making of nuclear weapons, was done by approximately 1,000 white people, men and women, from the scientists down to the technicians, etc. About 1,000 people were responsible for everything to do with the nuclear stuff, including the building of the nuclear bombs. I later discovered that the nuclear bombs, can you believe that they built the nuclear bombs underground? They actually built the nuclear bombs in Pretoria, in the capital city of Pretoria. There were certain buildings, and they were building the components for the nuclear bombs underground in buildings in Pretoria. Wow. It wasn't like they went out into the desert to do it. Mm. They were doing it in Pretoria. And the whole story was in there. I found it so fascinating. The one thing I would like to ask, if it's ever possible, and I have already tried, is if ever we can get some member of P.W. Botha's family to just scan that little book for us and give it to somebody and just put it out for free for everybody to read on the internet, please.
How many pages was it? How many pages?
It wasn't big. It wasn't big. It was probably between 100 to 150 pages max.
Wow.
It wasn't big, man.
Wow. Was anything else interesting?
It was the story of the nuclear.
That
to me was the most interesting thing. Another thing was he had a photograph of the astronauts on the moon.
Yeah.
And he was quite proud of the fact that one of the astronauts came to visit him.
Oh,
and
wow.
And he... I'm not sure if it's Aldrin who visited him, but one of the astronauts visited him and gave him the photo, and he proudly put it on his wall.
Wow.
Those are the most important things.
Now, did he ever discuss the international pressure and war against South Africa or the whites of Southern Africa?
Among the things that we did discuss was he spoke about Rhodesia, the Portuguese, and South Africa all being under total war, that there is a move to destroy us all, and that the same people, basically the same people who want South Africa destroyed are the same people who are destroying the Portuguese and Rhodesia.
Well, that's a new world order.
You know, that's the communists and their new world order buddies.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what I'm going to do, Jan, is I'm going to wrap the live stream up soon. We've been going for an hour and a half, and it's been absolutely fascinating hearing about your time with PW. But before I do, PW died of a heart attack at his home on Tuesday, the 11th of October, 2006, aged 90. What were your immediate thoughts when you heard of his death?
Well, I must tell you, I was very shocked. In fact, what happened was I had left his house and I'd come back home.
Because he just to be clear, Jan, he died only days after you stayed with him.
Yes, this is the freaky part. So listen to this. I've got photographs of him that I took. I must be among the last people who ever took photographs of P.W. Botha. It was the Rapport people and myself who were probably the last people to ever take photographs of him. And after I left, I was at home. I woke up 6 o'clock one morning, and I switched on my radio alarm. And as I was snoozing, the news came on and they said that P.W. Botha passed away. And I was absolutely shocked. I couldn't believe it. I was like, no ways. Mm. I last saw him alive 11 days ago and he was absolutely fine. And he and I, we had discussed his health. We discussed his health. And a topic that has come up before, and I'm going to put it out there because I think that there's more to the events of P.W. Botha than meet the eye. That a long time ago, there was a Russian ex-KGB guy called Golitsyn. And in 1984, Golitsyn wrote a book called New Lies for Old, and it was a big expose of the Soviet Union. Golitsyn made the point that the Russians have got a poison that gives you, that can kill you, a poison that can give you a heart attack. And you will get a heart attack and it'll be like natural. You will die of natural causes. And when they examine you, they'll think that it was just your health that gave in. But if you look at P.W. Botha, you'll see he had this weird heart attack back in 1988 at a very convenient time, at a very convenient yes. time, and then he, and so forth. And then you'll see that suddenly he just drops dead. And I must tell you, I asked the question, and I even raised the issue with him when I was at his house. I said to him, back in 1988, weren't you poisoned? Didn't somebody poison you? And we actually kind of discussed that, and he himself was kind of half open to that idea. So I personally am just plain suspicious, okay? I'm plain suspicious. I can't yeah. say anything with certain, but for with certainty, but I found it very weird. You know, and you know what? In the year 2006, with that DVD of the interview that came out, and then me writing a whole bunch of articles, more and more people were getting interested in P.W. Botha. And the yeah. next thing you know, boom, he's dead.
Yeah. Well,
I am very suspicious.
Well, what I'd say about the timing of the other incident, which happened in the 1980s, where he had the stroke in January, that was 2 days before he was supposed to attend a very important discussion about the independence of Southwest Africa, which was then to become Namibia. And because he had had the stroke, he couldn't attend it. And he was very determined to keep Southwest Africa as part of South Africa. So you know, what you're saying makes sense, because by putting him in that health position, he wouldn't attend what was a very, very important meeting.
Yes, and then others could turn around and say, yeah. oh, well, you see, his health is bad, that's why we have to put de Klerk in. Because remember, de Klerk just came in. He wasn't even yeah. voted in or didn't stand for election or nothing. Yeah. And you are right. You mentioned the importance of Namibia, Southwest Africa, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
The handover, absolutely. The beginning of the end.
Now, what I'm going to do to wrap up, Jan, is I've got a bunch of questions here from people that I want to put to you. Jan Fillion has said, hang on, that's a personal message, so I won't bring that up here in our discussion. John Moslin has said, is the nuclear reactor still working at Pelindaba?
I wouldn't know. What I do remember discussing with P.W. Botha about nuclear stuff was he said to me that South Africa, meaning the whites, we still have got nuclear knowledge, important nuclear knowledge. But he said some of the scientists are getting old and they're dying. And he specifically mentioned a certain doctor. It's in my notes here. But he said that this was the guy who started the whole process of nuclear uranium enrichment. Wow. And I think that guy has probably died. So I suspect by now that lots of our guys are dead and that we may have lost some of our best minds by now. So I don't know the full state of the situation. I do know that Kuberg is running quite well. Hmm. And I'm not sure if Kuberg still has got some white nuclear scientists there or who runs it. I don't know.
Right. Well, if Tanel has any sort of guidance as to what would be happening, it wouldn't be good with any chance of South Africa getting back into that area. Okay, now Jaguar or Clive has asked, please ask Jan about the rumors that Nelson Mandela was executed and the man we know was an imposter.
That I would not buy at all. In fact, you know, one of the photos I found in my archives, I found a photo of Nelson Mandela's new prison building. You know, he actually, towards the end of his time in jail, they actually put him in a lovely house. He's got a house with a swimming pool. He was treated well. And you know something about Mandela? You know, Mandela was found guilty of treason.
Yeah.
And in that Rivonia trial, Mandela should have been executed. Mandela should have been executed back then in the early 1960s, but he wasn't. And I suspect that also that there's some kind of weird pressure, weird politics as to why the South African government did not execute Nelson Mandela. So the mere fact that he stuck around, I think other people were protecting him. Whether it was pressure from overseas, or whether they just believed that executing him would turn him into a hero, I don't know. But there is some reason why. Why didn't they carry out the law and execute him? Because yeah. He should have been.
Well, it's interesting that Mandela was, after he came out of prison, suddenly a 33rd degree Freemason. And there are photos of him, you know, wearing the sort of the garb that they wear. And especially the one with the big white crosses on a black, it's like a tunic. I don't know if you've seen those, but he's standing next to prominent people in these sort of clearly secret society organization.
Well, what I will say is that I have actually come across that many black politicians in Africa in recent times, I'm talking recent times, have become Freemasons.
Mm.
So Mandela had many friends, including Jews. So Mandela could have all kinds of connections. He could have all kinds of connections.
Yeah.
No question about it. But I wouldn't say that he was killed and you're seeing a copy. No, I don't buy that.
Yeah. Now, Shirley Dewhurst has asked, please ask Jan about Kortbroek.
Now, that's interesting. Van Schalkwyk, I think, is his name. If that's interesting, I remember this guy vaguely now, but I remember he was a very important player in the final days of the National Party. And just as I was going through my notes here, as I was going through my notes of my discussions with PW, he actually said there that Kortbroek was a member of National Intelligence, that he was actually taken in as a spy. So I don't know the rest of it. I'd have to refresh my memory on Kortbroek, but I remember that he and that other guy, the guy that I refer to as the Canary, he was another one of the clowns in the final days. I can't remember all the issues he got up to now.
Right.
But, yeah, so he may have been working for National Intelligence.
So they were the guys undermining the status quo.
There must be a lot of stuff that went on, I must tell you.
Yeah.
Lots.
Okay, now Fiona Timms has said, I gather that plots to hand over South Africa to the blacks began as early as the 1930s. Could Jan expand on that, please?
That I haven't heard about. I haven't dug into South African history going that far. But let me put it this way. South Africa in and of itself is such an important nation with so much wealth that, you know, ever since the British conquered the Boers and crushed the Boer republics, that I don't think that South Africa has ever been truly free. That, you know, coming to seize the wealth of the Boer Boer republics, because they had gold and diamonds, they had stacks of it. You know, I think at the time, remember, the gold back then meant something because all currencies were backed by gold at that time. And I think, I stand to be corrected, but I think that the two Boer republics had one quarter of all the gold in the world.
Wow.
At that time.
Yeah.
And that's why the British came and looked for any freaking excuse to kill the Boers and crush them. It had nothing to do with the Uitlanders and maltreatment of the it had nothing to do with that. They came here to capture the super incredible wealth of the Boers.
And that was directly for the Rothschilds. That was directly for the Rothschilds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Rothschilds even sent the British soldiers a Christmas. The Rothschilds sent every single British soldier a Christmas card and a present. Every single. And the British, in order to conquer the handful of Boers, had to bring in almost 500,000 troops. Yeah. And the Rothschilds handed personally paid for all their stuff. So I think that in the time of South Africa, this is my interpretation when I look at history, is that the Boer Afrikaners tried to regain political control because they lost control of everything. They lost control of the money, the politics, the military, the everything. And they tried to figure out a way to regain some power in South Africa. And that's where the Broederbond comes from. And apartheid, actually, in my view, was the 48 years that the Boer Afrikaners managed to control South Africa mostly. They managed to get political and military control of South Africa, but they did not have full control of all the other stuff. And you've still got all those British links, etc. I don't think that South Africa is a fully independent state. That a nation like Britain is the part owner of South Africa. And the Americans are also now floating around. I don't think this country is truly free or has ever been truly free, even under black rule. Even the blacks don't have full control of it.
Well, look at Lord Renwick. He always keeps on popping up next to Julius Malema. And it's interesting that other billionaires are starting to now pop up next to Lord Renwick, and I'm talking about South African billionaires. I'm not going to mention the person's name here, but some people watching tonight will know who I'm talking about. I also just want to mention, we're talking about billionaires, the fact you talked about the taxi industry was started by P.W. Botha and was supposed to be in the hands of the blacks. The biggest taxi or black taxi owner in South Africa today is Johann Rupert. Isn't that interesting?
No.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you see, what you've probably got is a new, let's call it Broederbond or Freemason or whatever you want to call it, and it's controlling, it's got money, and it's busy with its games.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
All right. Well, look, Jan, thank you so much for joining us now. Is there something you'd like to just say in closing about P.W. Botha and your... any particular message you feel that he would like to give to South Africa? Oh, and just a short while ago, just for the record, I moved the camera and I showed the apartheid flag on my wall here in my room because I fly it very, very... I'm very proud to have one of these flags. And I'll just quickly point to it again. There it is on the wall. And I mean, to me, it's a symbol of hope for people against the oppression of the New World Order. That's my views anyway. Jan, back to you.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of a message, this comes out also in that interview. I will send you the link in the next 30 minutes. In his interview, he's asked about the future of the Rainbow Nation, and he laughs at it, and he says, well, there's no such thing as a Rainbow Nation, and he basically regards the country as a mess. He also said to me something like, die ANC is so deer mekaar soos 'n kraai nes. And his message to the people, including the young people who've left the country, he said, go and acquire knowledge and later come back to South Africa and fight for a new dispensation. He did not see this as the end of the Boere and that kind of thing. He did not see that as the end of them. And in fact, he actually reads out, there's something he loves about the Boers. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, I think it is, He wrote a lovely piece about the Boers, and P.W. Boerter loves that piece to bits. Mm. But I agree with the view that nothing is over, and the Boers mustn't quit, and no white South Africans should quit. I don't think the current system is going to deliver anything to us. P.W. Boerter himself definitely didn't think that either. I think that whites need to figure out some new system, whether it's secession or whatever it is, but there's got to be something, and I think that we must work towards something, definitely. Right. So and a final one.
Yeah.
I asked him if he thought, he and I discussed the issue of white unity. Did he think white unity is possible? And he said yes. He said white unity in South Africa is definitely possible. The English and the Afrikaans people did work together, and it can be done again. And right. I definitely think that's the way to go.
Right. Well, just getting back to secession, I think the Western Cape breaking away and setting up a separate state would be an incredible move. And I'm pretty sure that if they did it right, a lot of expat South Africans would return to South Africa. And I'm talking about the brain drain people.
Are you speaking about Hein Marx and the ULA?
There are a number of organizations. There's Cape Exit, there's ULA, there's Cape Independence Movement that Dr. Peter Hammond is actually sort of like the fellow who's sort of moderating the discussions they have. There are a number of groups that are now moving towards independence in the Western Cape.
That would be awesome. That would be awesome. We need, I personally think that South Africa anyway is going to break up. And in fact, I think Africa as a whole is still going to be torn apart. And I don't think it's that far into the future.
Right.
So I think you will eventually find others even breaking away. The Zulus might even break away eventually. Yeah. So the whole thing is for the whites to grab a chunk of territory for themselves. Mm. Obviously, the ultimate prize would be the return of the Boer republics.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Jan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. There's so much we could be talking about. We'd be going on for hours. Now, I do have to wrap this up because we've been going for 2 hours. And I do apologize once again that we got you on a bit late, but it was necessary that people knew what happened with our website earlier today. Take care and have a great evening.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on.
And
thanks very much.
And we'll
chat again.
Yeah, we look forward to having you on again on another subject.
Okay, bye.
Okay, Jan, take care. Bye for now. All right, guys, that was Jan Lamprecht. Always fascinating talking to Jan. He's someone who really knows his history in South Africa and looks at it from basically a credible perspective, unlike the fake mainstream media, which we did make reference to during this discussion. Have a great evening, and I'll see you tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Johannesburg time.
And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know, you don't thank the
Every day of your break in bed, and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends, and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports, and fancy coffee too. Energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.